last time, and maybe try to clarify and reinforce it. I also wanted to say, please let me encourage you again. Slowly down, asking questions. If you're not feeling that you're quite following the point, get me to try and re-articulate it. Maybe there's another way of saying it. Let's try and keep together in the discussion. So I started last time using the example that comes from Feynman and Hibbs as a motivation for the carpenter. The idea was we started thinking about the two-slit experiment, and then we thought, well, you have several walls, you can make holes in those walls. It's a nice motivation. It's a way of getting started with the idea. It does have perhaps the slight conceptual drawback that we used it as motivation for a discussion of a path integral in one dimension, and it's actually an experiment that, well, realistically, is taking place in three dimensions, and at least there are two relevant dimensions in the experiment. We have. At least the x and y coordinates to worry about. So when we actually got onto the calculations, we were thinking simply about calculations in one space dimension and time. And you could take the motivational discussion as a sort of stimulus to thought, if you like. Everything from this point on followed from the actual calculations we did. So we had one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, the Hamiltonian for the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, some wave function at time zero, the unitary time evolution operator that pulls the state forward. And then, as you probably remember, we split the evolution operator into n copies of little evolutions through time delta and started introducing position eigenstates like so. And so a picture of paths was built up from time delta, time two delta, time three delta, associated with these decompositions. So here was our coordinate x1, x2, that's x2, I guess, x1, x3. And so on. So here we have some particular path in one dimension and the corresponding amplitudes, and then here we have the integral over all such paths, and we have to integrate over the product of those amplitudes. So I was asked last time, are these paths going backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, or just back, or just forwards? We'd better define our terms. But if the question is, are they going backwards in time as well as forwards in time? They're not for the moment. We're picking out time coordinates, time delta, time two delta, and so on. And in each time coordinate, our calculation picks out some unique space coordinate, x1, x2, and so on, that contributes to the path integral. So for the moment, we're not allowing this sort of behavior, where the path goes like this and then goes back on itself, so that we end up with something complicated like that. The
The x-coordinate is a single-value function of time, and our paths are given by x of t Now, I think the question was certainly a good one, and the reason for asking it is that when one moves ahead to looking at quantum field theory, you are going to have to worry about paths that go both forwards and backwards in time. But that's an interesting issue for the future. For the moment, I just wanted to re-emphasize that this particular calculation is in non-relativistic quantum mechanics with a standard direction of time. We don't have to worry about particles being created and annihilated. We don't have to worry about this sort of behavior in the calculation we've done so far. And then we got on to what I think is a critically important issue, the relationship of the path integral to classical mechanics and quantum theory. And I was trying to make, and we were discussing, two points. One which you might take as a positive point. We can understand a great deal about how classical mechanics relates to the path integral by looking at the behavior of paths close to the classical path and remembering that because the classical action is stationary, the nearby paths are going to reinforce the contribution from the classical path. We expect constructive interference, and we expect generally that paths far away from that are not going to be stationary. The phases are going to oscillate wildly. We expect destructive interference. So that was the positive point. The negative point was this conceptual warning. I tried to stress what this isn't telling us, and it isn't telling us that classical mechanics in its totality logically falls straight out from the path integral. I thought it was maybe worth spending a few more minutes just trying to reinforce that and underline that point. So we have two ways to think about this. I mean, the first is what I've already stressed here. If we wanted to conclude that classical objects I guess this is the sort of thing we might want to conclude. With very high probability, and two, a very good approximation, follow the classical, in other words, the classical trajectory, in other words, the trajectory for which the action is stationary. But if we wanted to conclude that, we'd need to deduce it from some more elementary statement about the path integral. And that statement would have to talk about objects following paths with some probability. So we would need some more basic probabilistic interpretation of the sum over path amplitudes. And we don't have one, and one could just leave the discussion there. But I think there's a little more that is worth saying. And that we... that we touched on last time. So it's still tempting to think that we can, even if we don't in general have a probabilistic interpretation, that in the situation where we have a classical trajectory, it's unique, it's well-defined, that's stationary, a stationary point of the action, a probabilistic interpretation naturally falls out. So the idea would have to be but once we see we're in this sort of situation where we've got cancellations over here, cancellations over here, constructive interference along here and nowhere else, that we can naturally interpret that as saying this collection of paths that's very close to the classical path is the collection of physical paths, and the rest are physically irrelevant, something like that. So even once we've taken on board that moral, it's still tempting to try to argue the nearly classical set of paths selected by the by this mathematics of cancellations and reinforcement. And it's so tempting that authors often do indeed say basically that. Even Feynman says something very like that in Feynman and Hibbs in their book. So it's certainly a point that deserves close scrutiny. Several people raised interesting points about this, tried to sort of suggest ways in which we might be able to make at least progress towards some conclusion like that in the last lecture and at the end of the last lecture. Can I suggest a strategy where there's a certain, you know, one's trying to make sense conceptually of mathematics, and this will come up not only in quantum theory, but elsewhere in physics. A strategy that I find helpful is to try and separate out the details of the mathematics from the conceptual arguments. So try and find some sort of toy model in which the spirit of the argument, if it's a valid argument, should still run, and in which we're less distracted by complicated questions about measures over paths and whether we really have anything that's rigorously well-defined or not. So here's a toy model. So this is not physically correct, but that's not what it's here for. A toy model in which we could we can try and examine this argument a little bit more closely. Okay, so in my toy model, we're interested in paths from A to B, and just because we say so, we're just going to make up a rule that says the only relevant paths are ones that are piecewise linear. So here's, let's take this to be halfway between A and B. So that's T over 2. T over 2. Let's simplify things further. So this is at x equals 0. And this is also at x equals 0. So the only relevant paths are going to be things that go to some point, let's call it y, at t over 2, following a straight line from A to that point. And then from that point, they follow another straight line to B. So we restrict to paths built from two straight lines. And let's just suppose that we've got a calculation for the amplitude of each of those paths. So let's suppose I'm going to set h bar equal 1 just to simplify our discussion a little bit further. So suppose the amplitude is e to the I y squared. Why that? Well, at least that has some sort of resemblance to the situation we're actually interested in analyzing. We have a quite simple function defining the phase, a function which has a stationary point, and given the symmetries here, I guess a natural stationary point, y equals 0. So our idea is that this dotted line, the straight line from A to B that goes through y equals 0, is going to be our version in this toy model of the classical path. So this is the classical path in the model. Okay, so let me draw y squared. If I look at, say, the real part of that function, it's going to be what, 1 at y equals 0. So the real part of e to the I y squared. And it's stationary there, and it is going to start oscillating with greater and greater frequency this way and symmetrically this way. You can do a better sketch than that, but I guess you get the idea. So in this toy model, the version of the argument we're trying to run goes something like this. Our representative classical path is a stationary point of this amplitude. And the nearby paths have almost the same phase. So they will add up together to produce something. And then, well, out here things oscillate very, very quickly and they cancel out. And we see even in this toy model there's some question over rigor. Can we really say that the integral over the whole thing is given by this term and everything else cancels? But we can, let's just take it as an article of faith for a moment. We can believe that there is there's some way of justifying that, maybe with some sort of limiting process. So our argument is going to be these are the approximately classical paths. The rest of these are exotic non-classical paths, both sides. And we'd like to argue that somehow the set of approximately classical paths emerges as the only physically relevant set from the fact of these cancellations and reinforcements. So we'd like to argue two things. First, that they determine the actual amplitude, the sum over all the amplitudes for all the paths. Well, and modulo our worries about rigor, that's, we're going to assume that's true. To get to a conclusion that says that we can actually say these are physically selected, the particle must follow, if not the classical path, then something very close to it. We need more than that. We need that not only do they determine the mathematics, but that they are selected by this fact. So they uniquely selected. By this property. Thanks, yeah. Now just now. That's here. Yeah, there we go. Oh, excellent. There's a whole bonus board behind it. Sorry, what?
Why are we analyzing the root of
r? Only because I can't draw complex numbers. The point is, if the real part is close to one, then since the whole thing has modulus one, the number itself is close to one. So by looking at the real part, we can actually understand at least whether it's close to one or far away from one. I could certainly draw a second plot with the imaginary part as well. So let me add a comment there. They have that amplitude close to one. Notice that there's only one singular path here that actually has amplitude precisely one. It's a stationary point, but the amplitude does nonetheless vary. So if we're going to select some set of approximate paths, which was has to be the aim of this argument, it's going to work at all, because we certainly don't believe in classical objects. We can pick out one precise to infinite precision unique path. H bar is non-zero after all. If we're going to do that, we're going to have to look at things that so amplitude A is approximately things that are within some small number, epsilon of one. Okay, so that. That's another little worry, but let's just accept it for the moment. There seems to be a little bit of arbitrariness in our choice of epsilon, but let's assume we can pick some small number epsilon. And that tells us exactly which paths we think are close enough to the classical path to be relevant here.
Adrian?
Yep?
A question about the second point. This property, does that refer to the sum?
It refers to property one. So.
To only the sum. They should be selected by only what we get for the result of the sum.
Yeah, so the idea would be that. Let me spell this out by this property. In other words, the sum over. Let's call this class C, the set of approximate. Sum over C of amplitudes. Is I'll move it down. I hope I'm not spelling this out too pedantically. I mean, it should be sort of becoming clear to you that this is not going to work. We cannot select uniquely the approximate classical path by an argument of this sort. So let me just say. Couple more words on why that is true. So this is going to fail if we can find other classes of paths with the property that you sum over the amplitudes for the paths in that class, and you also get the sum over all paths. And you can. There's a sort of natural way of thinking of this calculation is these things reinforce and the rest of these things cancel and the rest of these things cancel. And if you do it that way, it looks like this set is somehow special. But of course, you can any time you've got a plus one and a minus one, you can cancel them off. So instead of taking us some path here that has amplitude close to 1, you could throw it away. You could say, well, that path's going to cancel off with a path here that has amplitude minus 1. And in its place, I'm going to pick, say, a path from this peak. Let me bring that diagram down a minute. And you notice these peaks may they're not stationary points of the action. But nonetheless, there's a region that may be much, much smaller, but is nonetheless non-zero, in which they also have amplitudes satisfying this property. Sorry, I should have drawn this better.
Would it be correct to assume that epsilon is somehow dependent on the size of the object in question?
I get, I We're sort of brushing that on the carpet, but I guess that must be right. Yes, yeah. I mean it's got to emerge.
If the size is big, then you would want the epsilon probably to boost to something like 8 bar, something that is small.
Right. But the point is, for this argument to run at all, there has to be some epsilon. We could just.
Yeah, but if you choose one epsilon, then even quantum of follow
collapse. Oh right, no, sure. We're going to have to work. This argument is going to have to run case by case, and we're looking at. But we're assuming we're working with a classical object, and we've got some justification for some choice of epsilon for that particular case of the classical object. Yeah, thank you. Okay. Now, so all of these peaks come up to one, and at each point there's a little region which satisfies this constraint of having amplitude close to epsilon, and so. If indeed it's the case that the sum over this set is equal to the total sum, it's also the case that I can swap around contributions. I can throw away this little bit and replace it by this one. So that one's gone, and that one's been added. And I can throw away another little bit here, just mathematically. I mean, I don't need to give any deeper reason for doing that at the moment. I'm just looking at ways to make the arithmetic work. So I can replace another little bit of this that I've drawn in orange. I'm trying to be realistic, but maybe I should just do it not to scale. So there's a little contribution from this peak, and this one's now been thrown away. And so on. And who knows exactly how this trade-off is going to work? I mean, maybe we'll only eat away a small piece of this set. Maybe we'll eat away a large piece. You'd have to think about that. But it's a piece of non-zero measure that's going to be eaten away. And we found other sets that include non-trivial little sub-bits of exotic paths that have the same property as the set C. So we can construct other sets C prime such that same property holds. The more you spell it out, the more obvious I kind of think and hope it seems, until you almost get embarrassed stressing it. Really, if we take the analogy a little bit further, it's as though we've got some sort of series like this, 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, and then it starts going like this, 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1, and we've got, again, some sort of argument that says we can justify saying that those cancel off in pairs, and so the series sums to 4. And now somebody comes along and says, well, there's something special about these first 4 ones. They're selected by this calculation. They sum to 4. The series sum to 4. Therefore, whatever physics was supposed to underlie this calculation is associated with whatever is associated with these ones and not the others. But of course, that's kind of silly. I mean, you could just as well cancel this one with this one, and then then it would be these 4 that give you the sum. And so. Yeah.
Why doesn't the series sum to 5?
My first question is, have I made a mistake writing it down? No.
You could just pick the 5 first, and then.
Oh, I see. Yeah, sure. No, I mean, there are two different problems here. One is whether we actually have a rigorous way of doing these sums at all. You could also ask why it doesn't sum to 6 or 73. And I'm just assuming that we've got some answer to that. We've got some justification for saying that the sum actually is 4 rather than 5. And of course, we have that problem in spades in the path integral. We've got to, do we actually have a rigorous way of arguing these things converge in general at all? That's a worry, but I'm setting aside that worry. Yeah.
You have different points. It goes to the classical limit.
Okay.
I think it's not mainly because of the other terms cancel each other, but it's because of the absolute the norm of the amplitudes for each path becomes very small for the other paths.
The norm of the amplitude for each path.
Yes.
But you repeat the question.
When you do a path integral, you add up all the amplitudes for all the paths, and when in quantum case, all the amplitudes, their norms are relatively comparable to each other. But when it goes to classical limit, the S is much greater than H bar, and since the S is the S for the classical path is a saddle point, and the other path, their S is is larger, and then this factor vanishes quite fast.
So thank you for stressing this. We need to distinguish carefully between two calculations, one in which we have e to the is over h bar, where s is the action of the associated with the path, and another one which we could imagine, where we have something like e to the minus s over h bar. The argument you just gave seems, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds to me as though it applies to a calculation in which we have a contribution e to the minus s over h bar for each path. Then you could say, well, if S is minimal, then these contributions are large in absolute size. And if S is far away from the minimal point, these contributions are relatively small in absolute size. That would seem clear there. But the situation we actually have is this one, e to the is over h bar. So each path, the amplitude has modulus 1.
But the absolute value of this factor is always less than when you calculate
S is real. So the absolute value is always 1, and this is where our problems start, really. And this is why I think, although it's a little bit of a trek, I think it's worth spending time getting this discussion straight. Okay. Maybe I should now move on. Are there any more questions on this before I do? Good. All right. Now, hoping that display is going to come to life. Seems to have lost the projector at the moment. It's on RGB. Coming up at the back. There we go. Okay, so another reason for spending some time on this discussion is that we're touching on a problem that's a controversial one in modern theoretical physics, and you're going to. It's probably not the first you've come across. It's certainly not going to be the last you're going to come across in this area. There's a little somewhere in the foundations of physics, there's a little bit of an intellectual crisis, and you're gonna hear strong arguments for different points of view. If not on this particular point, although possibly this even, then certainly on closely related ones. And you're going to hear strong arguments from thoughtful people. So you're going to have to end up, in the end, make up your own minds and find ways to think for yourselves through questions like this. And if this discussion serves no other purpose, maybe it's a little bit of an illustration of some strategies for trying to get to grips with a problem and making sure that when people give you a superficially plausible narrative, in this case, path integrals imply classical physics, that you can actually pick that narrative apart a little bit, test it out in maybe some simpler toy model, and see whether you believe it or not. And I don't, I'll be pleased if you feel more and more confident as the year goes by about your ability to do that. I'm sure, I'm not so concerned to persuade you to believe one side of an argument or another, here or elsewhere, as to sort of help a little bit in giving tools to find your way to your own an answer that you're comfortable with. So let me stress, the general question of how classical physics and quantum theory are related is a controversial one. You'll find people who argue that they know how to solve it, they can tell you how to solve it, or at least they can give you a very plausible sketch as to how the solution works and point to some mathematical details that maybe need to be sorted out. But conceptually, they will argue there is a way to see that classical mechanics follows from quantum mechanics. On the other hand, the founders of quantum theory took a different view. Most of the founders of quantum theory took a very different view. They, Bohr and many of his collaborators, believed that you needed to presuppose the classical world in order to make sense of quantum theory. That there was one needs some almost dualist view of physics in order really to get anywhere. And that's something like that underlies what became to be collected in, under the heading of the Copenhagen interpretation. And it's certainly still true today that many theorists who've tried very hard to look at the connection between classical and quantum mechanics believe that we don't have any conceptually good path for deriving classical mechanics from quantum mechanics. It certainly matters. This isn't a philosophical question. It isn't a metaphysical question. It's a key issue in modern science, one way or another. Because after that's how science works. Your old theories die, but they don't just fall away and get discarded. If we have a better theory than an old theory that was working, it has to be able to explain why that theory worked where it did. We have to be able to derive the predictions of old theories within the domain where they're valid from the new ones. And we have many examples where that works clearly and beautifully and straightforwardly. Newtonian mechanics follows from special relativity, Newtonian gravity from general relativity. So if we really just can't do that, or at least can't see right now precisely how to do that in the case of classical physics and its derivation from quantum theory, if the skeptics are right, and there's a fair collection of thoughtful people who take this view, then something is missing somewhere. Maybe it's in our understanding. Maybe we haven't got the right tools or looked at things the right way. Or maybe there's actually something subtly missing from quantum theory itself, and it needs perhaps to be extended or modified in some way. There are certainly some theorists who would take that view. I only want to touch on this, but this sort of class of questions is one motivation for an experimental program that's ongoing, trying to probe the boundary between classical and quantum mechanics, if indeed there is actually such a thing as a boundary. So the one way of doing that is to start from a two-slit experiment, start from quantum interferometry, and try and push the realm of objects for which we could do interferometry further and further towards the macroscopic, towards the classical. That's a hard thing to do. But there's been a lot of progress in that in the last couple of decades. The Vienna group, for instance, have done interference experiments with buckyballs, C60, and indeed verified the predictions of quantum mechanics for that, and somewhat larger molecules. Fluorinated C60 on the right, and porphyrin, which I guess is not larger, but is picked out just because it's a naturally occurring biological molecule, and perhaps in some people's minds there's some particular interest in testing whether biology, life, makes any difference. It's hard to see a clear motivation for that, but there's certainly a strong motivation for pushing. It's hard for me to see. I'm sorry. There is a line of thought, we'll just say. But I think the stronger motivation is simply pushing towards the macroscopic and the massive. I just wanted to highlight that as something to keep at the back of your mind. If you want to read a little bit further about it, there's a very, very good volume that's been now in its second edition by Jos and collaborators on all about this question and the relevance and maybe the limitations also of our understanding of quantum decoherence to this question. There's also a very nice shorter review article by Max Schlosshauer in the States of America. And there's certainly a lot more to be said that will indeed be covered in the Foundations course later in the year. Okay, so that was actually quite an extended conceptual warning about not leaping too fast to conclude that the path integral approach solves all our problems. We already had it, really, but let me emphasize again, we also need a technical warning. We gave a definition of the path integral for a particular case. It was the one-dimensional Schrodinger equation. And even there, our definition was actually pretty ad hoc. If you think about how ordinary integrals are defined, the analysts of the 19th and early 20th century, Riemann and Lebesgue in particular, put a lot of thought and care into giving a general abstract definition of what it means to integrate a function, which tells you once and for all, or gives you at least a way of telling once and for all whether any given function is or is not integrable, whether the integrals do or don't converge. Here, we don't have such a thing here. We have a definition that sort of formally on the left looks neat, but which conceals a factor that we threw in really in the end because we had to make the calculation work. We don't have any fundamental justification for picking out these factors in all cases in general. What this problem seems to be crying out for is some general understanding of a measure on the space of paths which allows us to do all path integrals, or at least to tell whether and when and how any given functional is path integral. We don't have it. So you can worry that this is a beautiful intuition that has not yet been made rigorous, may or may not turn out to be rigorizable. People have certainly been working on it for quite a while. Another thing to stress is, although they give a rather beautiful way of thinking about quantum theory, calculationally, path integrals are often hard things to do. It's often easier to solve the Schrodinger equation another way, for instance. Despite all that, the basic idea is very elegant. If you're willing to just pluck definitions out and see whether you can make them work, you can generalize it to integrals over configurations of a field throughout space and time, and that's certainly important in field theory. Perhaps even further to integrals over evolving space-time, geometries of space-time. So, and we're of course in a realm where we don't know for sure what works in making sense of quantum gravity in particular. So this approach at least holds out the hope of giving some conceptually natural way of respecting Lorentz invariance, general covariance, and perhaps making progress there. Whether it works or not, well, that's something for you to explore further in other courses. Yeah, certainly in the context of quantum gravity.
Is there any completely rigorous theory of the Pfaff integral for the case when the amplitude is given by the other expression, e to the minus s over h, rather than the complex one, if s is...
Ooh, that is a good question. I think it... I think we're getting... Can I get back to you on that? Because we're getting sort of beyond my expertise. Like, let me get back to you on that, if that's all right. But that's a very good question.
I have a different question. When you define this limit to define the measure, does that normalization factor go to infinity? Because isn't delta like 1 over n? So you have something like n to the n over 2.
Let's go back a slide.
If this was like 1 over infinity, that might make sense. But doesn't this, is delta like 1 t over n or something?
Yes.
So this is like n to the n. Goes to infinity. So you're multiplying your...
Nonetheless, it does actually give us a finite expression. As an ion. Yeah, I mean, you're right. The whole... the whole thing is sort of worrying in terms of the rigor. Yeah.
So I have another question on Pfaff integrals and this additional constant in front of the integral, normalization factor, which you can choose to cancel this, the divergence part, so you can choose it so that you don't get this divergence.
Sorry, was that a statement or a question?
Yeah, a statement, which kind of replaces this problem of something blowing up.
Yeah, you're saying, is this a fair way of saying it? You can sort of hide this problem in a choice of normalization.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you maybe want to put some details on that on the Sci Wiki?
Yeah, I could. I mean, I'll get the notes off. I mean, I'll just take the source of it and copy it.
Yeah. I think people would be interested, so that would be very helpful. Thank you. Okay. What else did we sort of gloss over? Well, for one thing, I started this discussion by looking at propagators for the Schrodinger equation and using those in the two-slit experiment. I gave you an expression and showed how you could verify it, but I did nonetheless pluck that expression out of thin air. Here's an easy way we can calculate. Instead of introducing a decomposition identity into position eigenstates, we can introduce decomposition into momentum eigenstates, P, as in that second line there. I'm only going to do this once rather than a whole set of position eigenstates. So we're interested in the propagator X. This is for a free particle, so which, remember, was what we used in the double slit analysis. So e to the minus I p squared t over 2 mh bar. Introduce the integral dp pp. And what do we have? Well, we have a term on the right there that we can evaluate straight away because the operator just depends on P, and we have a bra that's P itself, so that we can write down. And then we have the inner product of X with P. Well, that's just e to the power PX over H bar. So we have the integral that I wrote down, and we already did, we used the Gaussian tricks to evaluate it. Well, okay, that part of the discussion we're just repeating here. So we have some reasonably slick way of obtaining that propagator from this calculus, so that's good to know. Let's also take a little bit more time to look at the structure of this propagator. Really, it just depends on x and t. I've written it there in the earlier notation. So final time, final position, final time, initial position, initial time, and I set the first two to zero. So there it is. Suppose we've got a classical particle going from point A, which has coordinates 0, 0, to point B, which has coordinates x, t. Well, we're still interested in the case of no potential, so a free particle. So it's just going to go, if it goes from A to B, it will go at constant speed, and the speed is just given by the slope here, v is x over t. So its momentum is just m times that, mx over t. And if we look at the classical action, we have no potential energy term here, so it's just given by the kinetic energy integrated over the path. In other words, classical action, we just pick up an extra factor, t here. It's nx squared over t. And so the propagator for the free particle is just given by an exponential of I, and then the phase term is the classical action for that straight line path over h bar. Why do I stress that? Well, for one thing, there's something else I said that maybe I glossed over it quickly enough that nobody decided to pick me up on it. But we're actually now left with two different ways of obtaining the amplitudes for the double slit experiment. Superficially, it's two different ways. We first did it by saying we can work out the amplitude as a sum of amplitudes for two different paths. One going from the source to slit A and then to the screen, and one going from the source to slit B and then the screen. And those amplitudes are given by the propagator. And then we said, well, actually, the right way to, or at least a way, a good way of calculating these amplitudes in general, is as a sum of all parts. So not just the two in red, but all the ones in purple as well. And obviously, all their infinitely many cousins that I haven't drawn there. So that obviously raises a question. If those calculations give a different answer, then we've got a problem. So, I guess the first question is, do they give the same answer? And if so, why? Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
I mean, really, in the first case, you just consider it not a single kind of state path. You consider something going through this step, through this step. So you didn't really specify the exact path. So there is kind of a freedom of choosing.
Well,
path
but I, on the other hand,
you talked about.
Yeah. On the other hand, what I actually put in, the amplitudes I actually wrote down were the amplitudes for the propagator, which are indeed given in the path integral by the amplitudes for the straight line path from the source to A. So you're right, but it does actually reduce, the question does actually reduce the whatever again. If we haven't got some fundamental problem here, then it must be the case that somehow all the other purple paths are irrelevant. Does anybody have any? Yeah.
Just a vague thought, like, it should something to do with the scale invariance of the whole problem combined with the superposition principle. But to put this somehow rigorous, I don't know.
So I like the thought that we should look around for sort of fundamental physical principles and see if they give us a quick answer. Scale invariance. What is there anything we can do with that? I don't know. Could you flesh that out at all?
Well, by the scale invariance, I mean that we derive the propagator from point A to point B, like over some finite distance and finite time, by splitting up the situation to small time intervals, and over all of these, we assume that it behaves in the same way as on the big distance. But I don't know.
Okay.
When we split up the time, we assume that the only relevant paths are those which are linear between the two times. So when we split up
do I interpret this right? Our actual definition of all the purple paths was as piecewise linear paths, and then a limit as the line segments get shorter and shorter. But we constructed them as though they were little propagators. That's certainly true. So there's some sort of... I can see scope for some sort of intuition there, that maybe we rescale the problem. I can't quite think of a way to turn that into a concrete argument right now, but that may be a... maybe it's possible. I can't see it instantly. Any other thoughts or any developments of that one? Okay, so again, as always, we have a problem with rigor, but let me at least give you an unrigorous answer, which is hopefully at least as plausible as our other unrigorous answers. We've seen that for the free particle, the amplitude for a linear path is just given by e to the I classical action over h bar. So piecewise, these red paths are indeed the classical paths. If we have a classical particle and it's going to go from the source to A, it's going to go along that straight line. If it's then going to go from A to the screen and that particular point on the screen, it's going to go along the straight line. If, on the other hand, it's going to go from source to B and then from B to the screen, well, we have to analyze in two stages, but if it's the case it goes from source to B, it will go on that straight line. And if it's then the case that it goes from B to the screen, it will go on that straight line. So each of those segments itself, since it's the classical path, is a stationary point of the action for the path, given that we've got the wall barrier there. So we've got to restrict our whole calculation to paths that actually make their way through the wall. It's got to go through A or through B, otherwise it doesn't get to the screen at all. So we have a slightly more complicated case than the case where we just had a single classical trajectory. We now have two paths that are stationary points of the action. But we can, hand-wavingly, unrigorously, but nonetheless, perhaps plausibly, run the same argument that really this... Excuse me. Really, we're talking not about a single path, but a small collection of nearby paths. But because this is a stationary point of the action, the nearby paths interfere constructively with it. And likewise, because this one is, the ones near to it interfere constructively with it. And so we get reinforcement of those two contributions. And on the other hand, all the exotic paths in this scenario, that are far away from this, interfere destructively. Their amplitude tend to cancel. So it's at least plausible, I think, from that argument that we haven't run into any fundamental problems. We can see some reason why those two calculations plausibly ought to give the same answer. Okay. We're about, I think, 3 minutes from the end. And I think rather than starting a new discussion today, this is a good place maybe to stop. Let me just say where we're going with this. I just want to give you the spirit of an idea that's set out in Feynman and Hibbs, of a sort of interesting trick, an ad hoc way of looking at paths for a relativistic particle in one space and one time dimension, which has some interesting features. It's worth keeping in one mind as another way of building intuition about path integrals. But I will postpone the rest of that discussion to next time. Are there any questions, any more questions on what we've covered today? Okay, so there's another lecture starting in a thing in about 15 minutes. So let's wrap up here for today, and we'll continue this tomorrow.